Here's April 6th.
And you're listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie.
And I'm Arlene Engelhardt. And you're listening to From a Woman's Point of View. We hope you'll stay with us through this next hour. I can tell you that it's going to be a fascinating discussion, and I think you're going to want to hear it. Mary will tell you a little more about it in a minute. But if you can't escape it, embrace the Florida heat and let WMNF take care of that extra vehicle you have no place to park. Donating is easy. Simply call 1-888-966-3885 or visit us online at WMNF.org to schedule your free pickup. That phone number is 1-888-966-3885. And support for WMNF comes from our members and UF Online, providing education to qualified students. As a top 10 public university, online students earn the same degree as their on-campus counterparts. Students can apply by June 11th for fall. UF Online students don't just log in, they connect.
Well, I was just listening to the news, and if you were hearing that people are upset because the Pope is not apologizing for some of the aspects of the church and removing children from indigenous families and educating them in the ways, quotes of the country where they are, where they were born, all that kind of stuff. Well, I will be really surprised if Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, Dr. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and I do not discuss the doctrine of discovery. And the Doctrine of Discovery was about, formally about 1493. And actually, it was a papal bull, which means coming from God, essentially, through the Pope, in that it would set the conditions. So when the explorers went forth, what they could do and not to do in claiming this land, first for Portugal, and then very shortly, Spain got into the act, and so then they were having a battle contested, and so the Pope had to come out with a new papal bull, in which they said that this was only to non-Christian nations, that you couldn't plant the flag and take whatever it is you needed to take, and eradicate whoever you needed to eradicate. That was a no-no. So. Anyway, yes, Doctrine of Discovery. And, with the fantastic marches last weekend, the young people were so great. And we were just so passionate, so articulate. And, I think that, I don't know about you, I thought I knew something about American history. I've always loved history, et cetera, and I was kind of aware of the Indian Wars. I was kind of aware, particularly being in the area of Illinois that I come from, that actually the hometown was Morris. Very near me is Seneca, Marseilles, Ottawa, Kankakee. And I remember as a young kid, actually, you watch all these Westerns, and I was so impressed the way the Native Americans rode horses that I really wanted to meet some Native Americans so I could learn to ride a horse like that. And as a kid, I started to look where the Native Americans were. And indeed, where were the Native Americans? So anyway, let me put this music on, and we will be coming back with Dr. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Arlene, did you need to say something?
Well, since you ask, I'll go ahead and mention it now. You're talking about protests, and there will be an event at the Museum of Fine Art in St. Petersburg tonight at 6:30. Bonnie Sigler, who wrote a book about the power of people when they take to the streets, or I should say it's mainly wonderful photographs of the various signs that people use. And she will appear in a dialogue with Kristen Shepherd from 6:30 to 8 p.m. today at the Museum of Fine Arts, 255 Beach Drive Northeast in St. Pete.
Well, actually, she's a terrific designer. She's a terrific, very creative artist herself. And she was so upset after Trump was elected. She didn't know quite what to do with herself, but being a graphic artist, and it works for a lot of different companies, making posters, etc., and graphic art, she started just to examine, some of the really famous posters, etc. And so anyway, she started to look at these. And so then she found there was a tremendous power, but also she was getting some similarities, etc. And so it led her into a lecture, and then at the lecture they said, why don't you write a book? And so I'm pretty sure that Mitch is going to have her at his noon show, and so I think you're really going to want to just keep tuned here all day, but I think you're going to find, Bonnie Seeler is her name, I think you're going to really find her fascinating, and then you can go meet her tonight at the Museum of Fine Arts in St. Petersburg. But let me put this music on and then come back with Dr. Ortiz.
Legislation's on the desk of a do-right congressman. Now he don't know much about the issue, so he picks up the phone and he asks advice of the senator out in Indian country, a darling of the energy companies who are ripping off what's left of the reservations. I learned a safety rule. I don't know who to thank. Don't stand between the reservation and the corporate bank. They'll send in federal tanks. It isn't nice, but it's reality. Bury my heart in wounded knee, deep in the earth. Cover me with pretty lies. Bury my heart in wounded knee. They got these energy companies who want the land, and they've got churches by the dozens want to guide our hand and sign our Mother Earth over to pollution, war, and greed.
Get it quick.
Bury my heart.
I'm going to pod this music down because I am so thrilled to have with us on the phone Dr. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. And the book we're particularly going to be talking about today is Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. But Dr. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz is really quite an extraordinary woman. She's an American historian. She's a writer. She's a feminist. She's author of Loaded, as I just said. But she also has written an extraordinary book, an Indigenous People History of the United States. But she's also, she came out of rural Oklahoma, the daughter of tenant farming family. And so she also wrote Red Dirt, Growing Up Okie, Roots of Resistance, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, Blood on the Border, A Member of the Contra War, and of course, The Indigenous People's History of the United States. But she got her PhD at UCLA. She taught in the newly established Native American Studies program at Cal State Hayward. And she helped found the Departments of Ethnic Studies and Women's Studies. So Dr. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, it is such a thrill to welcome you to the show.
Well, thank you, Mary. It's very good to talk to you.
Well, you know, before we get into Loaded, because I thought I knew something about this history, but of this country. But I realize that I'm not so sure that there are some aspects that we don't want to look at. And so if you don't want to look at them, you just kind of forget and ignore that they ever existed. And so I don't think we really have dealt with, number one, when the people first started coming to this country, the ones in the boat, so to speak, what happened? That was way before this became a country. But before I get into the Second Amendment, I want to ask you, because I think it's so interesting to me, because there you are, the daughter of a very poor tenant farmer, but also a Native American woman. But tell me, when you were a young child growing up, you really didn't know much about your Native American roots, did you?
Absolutely not. Nothing. Mm-mm.
And so I'm curious, how, because actually your father, his father, your grandfather, was one of the members of the Wobblies. And when you were having so much financial trouble, you lived with your grandfather. And so you actually knew a lot about the Wobblies, the labor unions, et cetera, before you ever knew anything really about Native American culture.
Yes, my grandfather, that family came from Missouri in 1907 to Oklahoma, which was the year of statehood. And my father was born that year. So it was a very tumultuous time as a labor movement all over the country, all over the world. But lesser known is that Oklahoma was a real hot spot, very industrialized with oil and gas and coal, and commercialized wheat and cotton. And it was called the Saudi Arabia of North America. So it was, it's given a kind of a bucolic flavor by John Steinbeck and others, but actually it was very industrialized. And so this was the time of the industrial workers of the world who were organizing these kinds of migrant workers who went from field to mine to oil, and different parts of the West working. And it was an amazing organization. But my grandfather was also in the Socialist Party, which was very radical at the time, and was organizing tenant farmers. So my grandfather had land. He was a veterinarian. But with the repression that came with World War One to destroy those who were against the war and the socialists and the trade, the people who are the workers who are organizing themselves. It was a brutal repression led by the Attorney General of the United States under Wilson. And also, they reactivated the Ku Klux Klan kind of death squads until my grandfather was actually pretty much run out of the area and moved to Texas. And my father stayed. He was only 15, but he stayed. And so I grew up in that same place where my grandfather's family had been, extended family.
And obviously you're a bright child, but tell me, was your mother also, because she was an orphan, right? And her mother was an orphan. And so was she aware of really much of her roots, or was she ashamed of them, or what? Do you remember?
Well, my mother was orphaned when she was 2 years old, and she had older brothers and sisters, and actually a baby brother. So they were kind of left, with their father, who was a kind of ne'er-do-well Irishman, a tinker, drunk, So they were just abandoned a lot. So she was then put into foster homes at some point, and then into a school where the Baptists ran the school kind of for these wayward girls. And she became a devout Baptist. She absolutely was an aunt of ours, actually her sister-in-law, my uncle's wife, who traced the background, and knew the oldest boy was about 10 years old, 7 years older than my mother. And so he knew his mother better. So they were proud of it, but no, my mother was absolutely refused to identify as Native at all.
Well, I'm going to up it to, you go to San Francisco, and you realize that actually you're still looked upon because you got the Oklahoma plates and Okie, and the Okies that came with the Dust Bowl weren't exactly looked upon as high class in California. And so tell me, I thought it was fascinating when actually you met this Palestinian family they left Palestine, and he compared actually the treatment of the Palestinians to the Native Americans. And did that surprise you when you heard that?
Well, that was in Oklahoma when I was 18.
Oh, you were still there. Okay.
Yeah, first year of University of Oklahoma. And my boyfriend, whom I married, was an engineering student. And this was a big petroleum engineering school, I think the only one in the world at the time. So there were lots of Middle Eastern students, Arab students. And one was Saeed Abalugad, who was a Palestinian with Jordan papers, and only 7 years before had been run out, you know, in 1948. His family had been violently evicted from their homes and became refugees. So I didn't know anything about that story at all. I didn't know anything about anything, really, in rural Oklahoma. Taught me in that 3 years before we moved to California, before he went back to work in Jordan, I learned a lot. Also, I had, you know, other mentors that came along, you know, and I was very open to knowledge because I didn't really have I had some strong beliefs, you know. I was a devout Baptist. And that started falling apart. So I just feel very lucky. I was influenced by good people instead of bad people because I was probably just very impressionable, you know, and lacking in knowledge at that time. So kind of a blank sheet to write upon. And I've always felt fortunate that I had this, you know, early knowledge of Palestine and colonialism, words like that that didn't even exist. He would compare. He would say, look around, the Palestinians are like what happened to the Indians here, you know. That so that was very early in my mind and kind of led me on my journey of historical studies.
And then you do end up in San Francisco. These are very, very politically charged times, et cetera. But then you're from a very poor background, and you don't always fit in. You don't feel you fit in, even though you're credited with one of the ones that introduced second wave feminism, et cetera. And so tell me, how did you get studying in Nicaragua? Because was that when you were studying a native tribe, indigenous tribe there in Nicaragua, did that kind of really send you in the direction of Native culture, if you will?
No, I had already been helping develop Native American studies since the early 1970s. When I got my doctorate, I taught in a Native American studies program. In fact, I taught there until I retired, and we formed an ethnic studies department. So I went to Nicaragua in 1981, years after their revolution. Actually invited because I was a specialist on Native peoples and land tenure. I had done my dissertation on the history of land tenure in New Mexico. And I was asked to look, you know, they had problems with, they were giving away land grants of abandoned lands. They were giving away land to the peasants, and they just considered these Native people, these Miskito and Sumo and Rama Native people as peasants because, you know, they looked like they were doing the same thing as the mestizo peasant, planting food, and, you know, but actually they had this deeper culture and knew what they had, the communal sense of communal lands and not private land ownership. So they were they were getting very angry at the revolutionaries, the Sandinistas. So that's, I just knew a lot of the leaders that took power there because they had grown up in San Francisco. And so I wasn't really, I wasn't going down there, you know, for an academic study. I was asked to take a look, and it was, you know, pretty clear to me immediately what the problem was. Well, even before I went down there, what they were describing, I said, I know what the problem is. You're not understanding. So that was, you know, not just me, but a lot of people in the American Indian Movement, the International Indian Treaty Council. I went down and, you know, kind of advised the Sandinistas on the Native people. So, yeah, that was... That really came out of my already existing academic and activist experience with Native land rights.
And so we come, Dr. Roxanne Ortiz, to now, and your book Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. And you probably read about Stevens and saying, you know, that we should abandon the Second Amendment. And Warren Berger, when he retired, didn't he say the same thing? But tell me, what was your response when you read about Justice Stevens saying we should overthrow the Second Amendment?
I know it, yep. Well, I think it's not as easy as he described. He said it would be easy, but, you know, to amend the Constitution, this is certainly with a Republican Congress, it's not that simple. We still have the Equal Rights Amendment. So I don't think it's that easy, but I agree in principle that, that's the problem. He says that is the, you know, the object that gives legitimization for what is obviously not ethically or morally legitimate of people having an average of more than 8 guns each, those who own guns, and the kind of hoarding of guns, that it's then an excuse. But he doesn't give any history, but I've read other things he's written over time and quote him in the book, that he, like many others, have a mistaken idea of what the Second Amendment was about. And I think that's a real problem with understanding the gun culture and what, you know, why the Second Amendment is a is an offensive and repulsive you know, white supremacist document that should be abandoned, just like Confederate statues. But that's because those militias and the armed men, self-organized white settlers, had the right to take Indian land, invade it, take it, kill the people, burn the crops, and simply appropriate their already developed land. And then it gets indemnified by the government, and that's how the whole continent was settled, with that kind of relationship between the individual settlers' motive, you know, economic motive to take land. And then later in the 1670s, when racial slavery, chattel slavery was institutionalized, they carved out slave patrols to also control the enslaved Africans. So that's really what it is. It has nothing to do with a fear of a standing army or, you know, Stevens said, the fear of a standing army. I think that's just a bogus argument, and it doesn't hold up. I mean, if there were fears of a standing army, that might be, but it has no relationship with why the Second Amendment.
Well, and I have spent quite a bit of time with your book because, you know, I find, well, you've got a marvelous kind of poem by Sherman Alexie, and I think it kind of nailed the book when he said, if there ever is a memorial to this genocide, which frankly has happened to Native people in this country, he said it would be relatively simple. You know, you would go into this room, you'd have to be alone, And you could lie or sit or stand, but you had to spend an hour, and there would just be one picture on all of the walls, the ceiling, and the floor, and it would be that of an Indian, a Native American baby whose body has been riddled by a machine gun.
Right.
And, you know, that the first part, and a lot of people kind of wonder, but now I think I understand why the NRA only put the second part of the you know, Second Amendment, because we think of a well-regulated militia, and we think, oh, well, the United States was weak, et cetera. They didn't really have an army. And so, of course, this would be important, you know, in defense of the country, et cetera. But now, you know, we've got forces so strong, it's unimaginable, and we've got National Guards. But it's
well, the army wasn't so weak at the time. They had been fighting for 7 years straight, and they had come out of having already state militias. The thing is, the state militias that became the National Guard were provided for in the Constitution. So there's no way that, you know, why they would put it in the Bill of Individual Rights and repeat state militias. There's no relationship between National Guard and the militias. The well-regulated simply means not a band of thieves. You know, in other words, property owners, proper people, George Washington, you know, to be able to go out and he took a... That was already going on for 150 years. In fact, George Washington was one of the principal land speculators who took survey teams out of, you know, militias, out into non-British territory over the Appalachians of non-settled territory. In fact, it was barred from settlement by the British, measuring the land there, these farming, native farming people, just now and then killing some, but mainly just survey, and coming back and selling that land. So they had a big, and he wasn't the only one. He was just the largest land speculator. They were all land speculators. So they had a tremendous financial interest in splitting with Britain and, you know, making that land actually legitimately belong to settlers who would then be U.S. citizens.
And as you point out in your book, a very important part, actually, of the Stamp Act and, you know, and then eventually throwing the tea overboard and all of that, is that actually the British were very opposed to the second part of the Second Amendment, the right of people to keep and bear arms.
No, they weren't. No.
No.
They weren't. They'd already existed under the British. It just wasn't Britain. There were no constitutions. You know, British still don't have a constitution. A lot of people don't have constitution. So it was already existent. And that's how the British first, you know, the British citizen settlers took the land. But at a certain point in 1763, the British stopped settlement in North America at the mountain line, at the Appalachian Allegheny Mountains, and no more. But the slave patrols went right ahead, and the native people who were still resisting within the colonies, especially up in New York Colony, Georgia, and all these militias, you know, these self-organized citizens' militias were organized. So the British just stopped settlement. They didn't stop. They had nothing against these settler militias.
But it was important for everybody, so to speak, to have a gun, because without the gun, how were you going to get the native people off the land? And land that was quite developed. I mean, I had no idea that it was one of the seven major agricultural developments in the world. And it makes sense, actually, when you think about it, that here these people came from countries, knew nothing about the land here, and yet they were able then to have crops, et cetera. And I don't think most of us stop to think that the right to bear arms was so important because, you know, well, we're given the impression, of course, that the Indians were always attacking the villages and the settlers, et cetera. And that's why they had to protect themselves. But obviously, that with Washington and people like that, the value was land. And so they kept going with their guns and either with just small groups or militias. And that's how they acquired the land, the manifest destiny, which they saw as ordained by God, if you will, that this was the right to take this land and to use it. And so, but the native people obviously didn't just want to give it up. And so I think that's the aspect of our history. And to me, that's the aspect of the Second Amendment, that when you stop to think that there, when Jefferson's, you know, writing the articles in Virginia, this is 10 years before the Constitution, it's very important that the person has the right to bear arms. And I think for a lot of us, we don't like to look and think there were 15 million Native people here about, you know, when the boats started to come over, and what happened to them and how it happened and with the gun. And I'm not saying the United States and the people that came here were the only violent people in the world. You know, that obviously they, you know, with the doctrine of discovery coming from the Pope, for both Spain and Portugal, that this was, you know, kind of the operative rules, so to speak, that legitimized it. But somehow we have almost fetishized our right to have had this continent and to have taken this land. And I think that you followed so brilliantly the thread. And again, we're talking Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz and Loaded. And as you just said, there were not only the Native people, the constant ongoing battles with that for land and the constant efforts of this, but also at the same time, they're bringing slaves and the value of slaves. And so then they have to be controlled. And so a lot of these militias and individuals are also doing that. And at the same time, then you get a civil war it's no wonder that the gun, so to speak, is the symbol of this country, if you will.
Well, yeah, and, you know, that, like you say, it's not unusual, and colonial warfare is violent, genocidal, wherever it is in the world, Africa, Asia, Latin America, the Caribbean, Pacific, but we have to ask what's different about the United States and why there's this persistence of gun violence and violence in general. And there's a whole deeper history there of the formation of the United States economy and institutions and society so solidly by 1840, actually, but of a capitalist economy based upon the buying and selling of human bodies and land. And nowhere else in the world is that the case, you know. So we really have to look at property and the relations of property and why then the guns become a permanent part of the culture, because to maintain that white republic, it only became a thing, you know, the Second Amendment. There were lots of guns, not as many, and, you know, hardly anyone had more than one, until the reaction against the civil rights movement and the desegregation decision. This is when all these militias began forming again. They didn't need to before because everything was locked down. They had, you know, Jim Crow in the South and total segregation in northern cities, Native people on reservations where they could hardly eke out a living, farm workers deported 1.5 million in the 1950s just without any law whatsoever, and called it Operation Wetback. So there was no bar to a total white republic, and then that was threatened. So what you have is the descendants of all of these people who think this country is theirs and anyone else is a guest. They don't want to let it go. And so this is, and it, you know, it plays also into the patriarchal nature of that landowning, where it was only the male, white male, who was a citizen and could even own property. So this is built into it too, the, you know, the male. But we have to remember that I'm kind of using, you know, the Trump election as a gauge for the size of white nationalism. And I would say it's around 30% of the total population, which is just mind-boggling. But 52% of white women voted for Trump. So, I, you know, you may be able to shave it down a little bit of this reason or that reason, but I think the only really reason that matters, and the collective reason, and it's not that people consciously even think it, is they want this to stay a white nation. They want it to stay a white republic. So that's what the Second Amendment actually bolsters. It's the one legal instrument they have left after the Civil Rights Act, after, you know, all the legislation and abortion, right? You know, the control of women comes into this. Evangelicals are mixed up with this, you know, the same white republic stuff. That's the only thing they have left is the Second Amendment. Some of them say that. They say, well, we've, you know, and people feel sorry for them. Well, we've been neglected and everything, and we're now the victims, and all we have, you know, is our guns. And they're telling the truth. I mean, this is what they are saying. They're actually saying why, you know, and they don't come out and say, of course, we're racist. No one says I'm a racist, you know. They don't do that, but I just have a white identity. It's just sort of like someone having a black identity. It's just a thing. But white nationalism is at the bottom of it. So that's why I say the Second Amendment is an odious instrument that people think is either benign, doesn't mean what it says, or like Justice Stevens is out of date. Because he said once in one interview, quite a while ago, that there are no Indians to kill anymore. So he kind of understood, you know. But that erasure of that history leaves a blank where people can't understand. And it's, the arguments go round and round and round, and they avoid, you know, what is the harsh truth and much more difficult to deal with than anything that legislation can do.
And you mentioned, you know, out of date. I'm thinking of Braun, the one who wrote Wizard of Oz. And it's interesting, he's the son-in-law of Matilda Jocelyn Gage, right, you know, who was one of the pioneers, actually. Right. Well, one of the early women at women's rights. And she learned so much, actually, from the native women in her area. In fact,
I think that's a myth, because she's the one that said, quote, about the Dakota people in Minnesota, we should give them back their land. 6 foot deep.
But also, though, but I'm more focused what he said. That after all the terrible things we have done to indigenous people, we have to wipe out all of them, and one final blow and wipe all of them out, or, you know, they'll come back and destroy us. And
yeah, but Matilda was, she may have been a feminist, but she was an Indian hater.
Well,
wasn't a friend of Indians. That is a myth. That is all. There's an appropriation. There's certain appropriations, but there's no real interest. She wanted Indians dead.
Well, and I think the thing that's so important, I think we need to understand, at least to me, about the Second Amendment was particularly the right to bear arms, the individual. That to me, it legitimized the going and the shooting and the killing of the Native Americans to take their land, to take their...
Well, it also makes the U.S. citizen, white male citizen, a kind of royalty, a kind of king, you know, that's not a peasant. Even if they're poor, they have this, you know, this puffed up sense of who they are, you know, that they are the king. And everything's structured that way for them to be that, because that's how the West was won. That's how the United States became what it is today. And if people think the United States what it is today is a good thing, I think they should really, you know, take a closer look at what it's doing in the world, you know, and what's happening in the kind of government that exists right now. Good things did not come out of this.
Well, and I think in your book, and to me, it's is also that if there were people who felt bad about this, maybe in their conscience they thought, well, couldn't we live together? Couldn't we become a society together? That it kind of legitimized, the Second Amendment legitimized that, but then you also follow the blood trail. Because right now, I mean, it's continued that, you know, our warring adventures, I mean, this whole century we've been in one kind of a war or a battle or a skirmish or another. And somehow that, you know, to make these weapons of mass destruction, and we have no compunction of not to do and using them. And the only actually limitation is deliverability. I mean, there is something seriously wrong with the moral soul of a nation that doesn't look at what these weapons are doing, and somehow to not realize that you can't be, you know, bombing nations and sending the drones now, etc., and not have at least psychological blowback. And to me, I think your book was so good because you follow that blood trail through. And I think we still have it right now with our use of war as an instrument of policy.
And that in itself, the militarism, return of combat veterans, almost all combat veterans who return who aren't, you know, their consciousness raised, the 1% or so that they hate war and work against it like Veterans for Peace, most of them, I've seen the figure 90%, you know, are maintain weapons. They're among the largest of the, you know, demographic of owners of civilian weapons once they're in the civilian world. So the military itself becomes a production of, you know, of gun ownership and gun violence.
Well, I'm looking at the clock, and you have been so extraordinarily generous with your time. And we have been talking to Dr. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and the book is Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. And I, when you read it, be prepared that you're going to have to spend some time thinking and actually dealing with issues that at least I found for myself that I haven't wanted to think about. I guess I've kind of seen this nation pretty much start with, you know, the war and the Constitution and all. But if we're going to understand, to me at least, where we are now, we've got to understand how we got here. And so, Dr. Ortiz, thanks so much for all the time you've given us.
Thank you, Mary. It was wonderful to talk to you.
Well, I'm going to read some of your other books, too, because this is...
thank you.
I haven't read the others, and I know they're going to be worthwhile. So thanks so much, and keep up the great work.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, she's a powerful woman. What did you think, Arlene? Oh, Arlene disappeared on me. Okay, I'm just going to put this little bit of music on, and then I want to bring a little bit of the highlights, I thought, of people who can get it. I think they really can look into the mirror and see who they are. But let me put this music on, and then we'll come back with some of the kids.
Can you remember the times that you have held your head high, told all your friends of your Indian claim? Proud good lady and proud good man, some great-great-grandfather from Indian blood sprang. And you feel in your heart for these ones.
Well, I'm going to pod this down because I'm hoping a lot of you were involved with the marches on Saturday. Are also watching or getting some reruns of some of the ones in D.C. and so many different areas. And this is just a little compilation, I thought, of some of the students. And I thought just extraordinary wisdom that they showed. So let's give a little listen to
this. Naomi, and I'm 11 years old. Me and my friend Carter led a walkout at our elementary school on the 14th. I am here today to acknowledge and represent the African American girls whose stories don't make the front page of every national newspaper. Whose stories don't lead on the evening news. I represent the African-American women who are victims of gun violence, who are simply statistics instead of vibrant, beautiful girls at full of potential. For far too long, these names, these black girls and women, have been just numbers. I'm here to say never again for those girls too.
When people try to suppress your vote, and there are people who stand against you because you are too young, we say no more. When politicians say that your voice doesn't matter because the NRA owns them, we say no more. When politicians send their thoughts and prayers with no action, we say no more. And to those politicians supported by the NRA that allow the continued slaughter of our children and our future, I say get your resumes ready.
6 minutes and 20 seconds with an AR-15, and my friend Carmen would never complain to me about piano practice. Aaron Feist would never call Kira Miss Sunshine. Alex Schachter would never walk into school with his brother Ryan. Scott Beagle would never joke around with Cameron at camp. Helena Ramsey would never hang out after school with Max. Gina Montalto would never wave to her friend Liam at lunch. Joaquin Oliver would never play basketball with Sam or Dylan. Elena Petty would never. Kara Lugren would never. Chris Hickson would never. Luke Hoyer would never. Marquin Duque Aguiano would never. Peter Wang would never. Alyssa Alhadaf would never. Jamie Guttenberg would never. Meadow Pollock would never.
I am a survivor. I have lived in South LA my entire life and have lost many loved ones to gun violence. This is normal. Normal to the point that I've learned to duck from bullets before I learned how to read. My brother, he was in high school when he passed away. It was a day like any other day. Sunset going down on South Central. You hear pops thinking they're fireworks. They weren't pops. You see the melanin on your brother's skin turn gray.
My grandfather had a dream that his four little children will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream that enough is enough. And that this should be a gun-free world. Period. Will you please repeat these words after me? Spread the word!
Spread the word!
Happy Heart!
Happy Heart!
All across the nation!
All across the nation!
We!
We!
Are going to be!
Are going to be!
A great generation!
A great generation!
Just a few of the many outstanding young voices we heard. And then I thought at the end, I really thought that the rendition that Jennifer Hudson did of Times That Are Changing was just outstanding. And Jennifer Hudson certainly has been affected by violence. I believe it was her brother-in-law that shot and killed Jennifer's her brother, her mother, and her nephew. And so she certainly has seen terrible violence in her life. And so, but I thought it was really, really moving. And so let's give a listen to Times Are Changing, because we realize they must. And I really feel that I really can't recommend this book enough, Loaded. It's just Arming History of the Second Amendment. It will give you a very, very different view, I think, of this country, and I think a very necessary perspective. But anyway, let me put this on by Jennifer Hudson, because for those of you who were out marching at other places, you maybe didn't hear this, and it's pretty darn moving. No, it's not the one I want. I want this one. Well, it doesn't seem to want to play it, so I will. Sorry about that. Maybe I can come up with it later. But Arlene, do you have any announcements?
I just want to thank everybody that has called and everyone that has called and emailed this morning. We appreciate your comments, and we hope to hear more from you. So if you have questions or comments, please be sure to get in touch with us either during the show, or you can email Arlene at WMNF.org or Mary G at WMNF.org anytime. And remember, if you didn't catch all of this morning's program or any of our past programs that you might like to hear some or all of, you can do that by going to the archives. If you go to WMNF.org, you click on programming and go to the 10 o'clock Thursday shot and put spot and put in the date that you want. You can also hear the program on Sundays on the internet on the source at 4 o'clock p.m. So you have lots of choices, and we hope you stay in touch. Keep your dial tuned to WMNF.
Okay, well, I'm curious, Arlene, what were people saying? Because I found, you know, that was pretty powerful stuff. And I think that, a lot of us, you know, I think we like to think we're better people maybe than we are. It's not that we're that much worse than anybody else, and it's not that we should be better than other people. But I think it's important that we really look and see who we are. And so I was just curious.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And one person posted in response on our Facebook page a photo, actually the mugshot of Dylan. And it says, turns out people get angry when you say white Americans are terrorists too. And, you know, sometimes we have, as Dr. Dunbar Ortiz was saying this morning, there are so many myths. So many times what we have accepted or been taught in our history classes really isn't the true story.
She really discusses that episode in her book. She thinks it was one of the most racist mass shootings we've had. And it's really fascinating, the fascination that Dylan had with Rhodesia and the attitude a lot of white nationalists have to the nations that they see as the old white Rhodesia and South Africa and some other nations. It's really quite fascinating. I mean, it really, the connections, I think, are really chilling between the militias that then became the slave patrols, and then so many of them got involved with police departments, and the effect of the Native American wars with our military. It really is a very sobering history, and I think it, anyway. Anyway, thanks so much for listening, and if you do get a chance to read it, it is really, truly worth it. So, okay.
And also, don't forget that tonight at 6:30 at the St. Petersburg Fine Arts Museum, you have a chance to hear a discussion with the author of
Bonnie Siegel. Siegel. Is that her name?
That's her name. Siegler. Bonnie Siegler. I was trying to remember the name of the book. It's such an impressive book. I think you'd enjoy hearing her talk.
I think some of the posters, some of the artwork is stunning. And you realize how through history, actually, because she goes way back. And she was sorry that she wants to do a second book because there were so many things she couldn't get in and so many other areas and sections that she is. But I think, and you will see them bigger on the screen, it's going to be very powerful. And, you know, protests, posters are really impressive. And she said that, you know, when she was watching the March for Our Lives, that she was very impressed with the homemade posters because you get more of the humor, but you also get the, you know, the feelings. And she saw this one, March for Our Lives, on Saturday, and it was like done by a child. And the child said, you know, that I thought you were pro-life. And so anyway.
And she will be a guest today on Midpoint with Mitch. So tune in or keep your dial set to WMNF for Radioactivity and then Midpoint. We'll be right back.
Maybe it's the movies, maybe it's the books, maybe it's the bullets, maybe it's the real crooks, maybe it's the drugs, maybe it's the parents, maybe it's the colors everybody's wearing, maybe it's the president, maybe it's the last one, maybe it's the one before that, what he'd done, maybe it's the high schools, maybe it's the teachers, maybe it's the tattooed children in the bleachers, maybe it's the Bible, maybe it's the lack, maybe it's the music, maybe it's the crack, maybe it's the hairdos, maybe it's the TV, maybe it's the cigarettes, maybe it's the family, maybe it's the fast food, maybe it's the news, maybe it's divorce, maybe it's abuse, maybe it's the lawyers, maybe it's the prisons, maybe it's the senators, maybe it's the system, maybe it's the fathers, maybe it's the sons, maybe it's the sisters, maybe it's the moms, maybe it's the radio, maybe it's road rage, maybe El Nino, or you V-rays,